Federal Trade Commission has the authority to enforce the federal antitrust laws. You might think that in doing so, in seeking to give the antitrust law shape through enforcement, the FTC would not try to drastically change how those laws are understood and applied. After all, the FTC's commissioners are not elected, and they cannot be removed, absent misconduct, by the president. They lack the democratic legitimacy or political accountability to revolutionize how the antitrust laws work. That's my view, anyway. Led by Chair Lina Khan, a majority, and soon all, of the FTC's current crop of commissioners seem to see things rather differently. Khan, for her part, has referred to the existential stakes of the agency's underreaching. Quote, when identifying the top 10 threats to the agency, she has said, going too far is, quote, not on the list. Small wonder, then, that the agency has been launching aggressive antitrust suits. This is the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Corbin Barthold. I'm pleased to welcome, for his first appearance on the show, Bilal Sayed, Senior Competition Counsel here at Tech Freedom. Before joining us, Bilal served as the Director of the Office of Policy Planning, the Federal Trade Commission's internal think tank. Bilal, welcome to the podcast.
All right, thank you. It's going to be fun. Happy to be here.
Yes, we have a lot to cover. Let's dive right in with the Meta Within deal. A few weeks back, a federal judge rejected the FTC's bid to block a deal by Meta to buy the virtual reality fitness startup Within. For those of you who aren't familiar, it's an app where when you put on your virtual reality goggles, you stand on a platform, you're in some beautiful virtual reality environment. And as far as I gather, I actually never used it. Balls come flying at you and it's basically exercise. They'd be so horrified to hear me say it. It's jazzercise for the new century. Looks very cool. The case was built on a little tested legal theory, at least that's how a lot of people have put it, that the antitrust authorities can go after and make sure that there is future competition in an untested or new market. There's been some speculation that the district court's order is actually something of a victory for the FTC because the court made good rulings for the agency on how the law works in that area, on how to assess competition in nascent markets. So Meta decides instead of building its own fitness app, it is just going to purchase Within, and the FTC says, well, you would have built your own or whatever. And the idea being that Meta just lost on the facts. How do you read the case? And do you think that that's true, that maybe the FTC can count this as a win in its own way?
Well, I've taken the position that I don't think it counts as a win. You know, other people have suggested differently, but I think there's not a lot of disagreement between, you know, those of us who think it was not a win and those who think it was a win on the law. They clearly lost on the facts, right? And that's the usually the relevant and interesting issue in so-called potential competition cases. They claim, I think, a win. Because the standard by which, you know, their claim or allegation was judged took what I'd call the lowest or easiest burden for them to meet if you look at sort of the existing case law, right? So the court suggested that or indicated that it would apply a test that would require the FTC to show that it was sort of reasonably probable or reasonably likely that in this case, Meta would have entered the relevant market, you know, but for the acquisition. Now, it's true that, you know, sort of that reasonable probability or reasonable likelihood standard is a relatively favorable standard for the FTC or DOJ. because there is case law, both Article 3 case law and commission opinion from the late 70s and early to mid 80s, that suggests a much higher burden. Those cases, you know, suggest, you know, a clear showing, a strong likelihood that the competitor not in the market or firm not in the market would enter the market absent the acquisition. So in that sense, the FTC won, but reasonable probability is, at least according to the district court here, in citing back to a, I think, Fifth Circuit opinion, is somewhere well north of 50%. And that's pretty high. And it is roughly consistent with the probability standard applied in the previous most recent potential competition case, a case the FTC brought in the 2010s against Steris, which at the time was thought to be, you know, that the court applied too high a standard. So, you know, it seems to me the FTC can claim a win, but it's not, I think they've really sort of solidified a standard at the district court level that they do not follow in their process of taking consents. And we can talk about that. And that, you know, a mere 5-7 years ago, they thought was too high a standard.
On a panel you moderated with former Chair Kovacic, you know, he was talking about how you often get these seeming wins on the legal standard, and then it ends up being a mirage for the commission. They end up then trying to prosecute the next case under that, and they still lose. And I can kind of see how that would be here, especially given that unless you have a true hot doc, a true smoking gun in which the company says exactly that they, you know, they plan to enter the market and then they ditch it and then they buy the competitor. How do you predict that hypothetical future? It all seems like just a fraught exercise of looking at sort of alternative universes.
Well, I think this is another area where the FTC claims a win, but which I think is not really a win. You know, the court in Meadowthin said something to the effect of, we're going to look at objective evidence, not subjective evidence. And what the court took that to mean, I believe, was objective evidence covers a couple of different types of evidence, or let's say evidentiary sources. It includes documents, like you suggested, documents that lay out the plans of the firm. It may also look to the firm's capabilities, financing capabilities, business capabilities, what you might call technical capabilities, personnel. And that is, of course, reasonable. What, of course, sometimes that evidence is conflicting. I would say more than sometimes, all the time, that evidence is not ambiguous, but it varies depending on the timeline of the project, let's say, or the consideration of entering, who's managing it, who's paying attention to it, and what other opportunities are available to the firm. So you rarely will see evidence that points in one direction. But at least that's evidence that can be weighed. It's usually not prepared in the context of the proposed acquisition, but in the ordinary course. What the court said it would discredit, and where the agency, I think, was pleased, is in what the court called subjective evidence, which was sort of testimony by, in this case, Meta executives that said, well, never mind all that, what we wrote down 2 months before the proposed acquisition, 6 months before the proposed acquisition. We're telling you under oath here in your courtroom that, oh, we never were going to do that, or plans have changed. And I didn't tell anybody, but, you know, we never wrote it down, but our plans changed and we're not going to enter. Mm-hmm. So The court said that type of testimony is probably less probative, not probative, but less probative. And, you know, we're going to deal with sort of the ordinary course evidentiary questions. What do we make of documents prepared in the ordinary course where people have different opinions, where projects stop and start? And that's what they do all the time. What the agency has done over time in consent orders, right? There, I mean, you know, you can identify 60 to 100 potential competition or potential competition-like challenges by the FTC over the last 25 years. In almost all of them, 80%, 90%, there's very clear evidence that the, you know, one of the parties, one of the firms that's not actually in the market has taken concrete steps to enter the market, right? And those cases are fairly easy where, you know, it looks like it's more of a time dimension to the question of when they will enter, whether as opposed to either the likelihood of successful entry or the decision to enter. Now, even those cases can be tough because many firms will start projects that will fail, particularly, let's say, in the pharma industry or healthcare or medical device area. But often in these cases that the agency, both agencies sort of bring on a routine basis, there's been some, what I'll call expenditure of sunk costs. They've drilled a hole, they've built a molecule, they've started a regulatory process. And that is often very compelling evidence for the agency.
Let me stop you there, because you know of what you speak here. The DOJ and the FTC are looking into changing their merger guidelines to better account for potential competition. We should be expecting those pretty much any day now. I've heard some law professors joke on Twitter about if it drops in the middle of their semester, how do they change their antitrust syllabuses? In response to that, you've written a paper that, quote, collects examples of the FTC's potential competition merger enforcement record to inform discussion on whether, and if so, how the merger guidelines might be revised. And I feel like you're already tapping that study, it sounds like to me. So just to be clear, we're on that terrain, and you're already kind of previewing this, you know. What's your finding? Is it actually sounds like you conclude that these issues are potentially more tractable than I made them sound earlier, or than, say, like Judge Frank Easterbrook has suggested in the past?
Well, I think they raise the same questions that all merger cases raise, right? Which is, what is competition going to look like in the, what would competition look like in the future absent the merger? It's potentially an easier question to answer, usually an easier question to answer, when both firms are actually competing in the relevant market at the time of the proposed acquisition. You know the level of competition, the success in a sense of one or both of the companies, but it's still predictive. You know, markets change all the time, I think. But in a situation where a firm is not a participant in the market, but for some reason you have some belief that they will be or could be, it's just obviously sort of more difficult, right? And it also opens up the question of who else can come into the market, given that we think we can do some type of probability analysis of firms that will enter. So the FTC's record, in particular the FTC's record over the last three decades, shows that this is it is an analysis subject to some form of what I'll call predictive uncertainty. The staff does it on sort of a, you know, what I'd call a best efforts basis, right? What's the evidence? We make a judgment. We, you know, both sides sort of make a judgment. You test it with the business people, with the lawyers, with the economists, and you say, okay, which argument is more persuasive? And the beauty, to just tie it back to the guidelines, the beauty, I think, of the guidelines is they allow this kind of broad-ranging analysis, different sources of evidence, different theories of harm, flexibility, in a sense, on the timing of entry, maybe even flexibility on the likelihood of entry. If you start to think about, as the staff often do and the agency leadership does, in their discretion of whether to bring a case or not, the magnitude of the potential harm, right? Although it's not really discussed in the guidelines, but I suspect it will be in the next set of guidelines, the magnitude of harm or potential harm goes into the staff or agency leadership's decision whether to pursue a case. I think that will be made explicit in the guidelines, that the magnitude of potential harm is a factor. That, I think, is one of the only changes that is probably required in the guidelines for them, not to be limited in what they can propose to a court. Now, of course, they're not limited at all, but sometimes the guidelines are quoted back to you by the court. And if the agency were to focus on this idea of magnitude of harm right now, the courts could say, where is this coming from? It's not in your guidelines. You're changing the analysis, midstream, and it's not, either it's not fair, or I have no, I have no precedential discussion to sort of base my analysis on. So that, to me, is what you'll see. There are lots of concepts in the potential competition cases, that could make their way into the guidelines, either explicitly or maybe more explicitly. But I think that would be a mistake, because many of the concepts in the cases, most of which are roughly 40 years old or more, are actually not as sophisticated as the horizontal merger guidelines are, or even the vertical merger guidelines, into either how harm may develop, or what evidence, what factors might you identify or use to identify a future competitor.
Trying to predict the future, we can segue easily into a pretty concrete example. When Facebook bought Instagram, at the time, even Jon Stewart, made fun of it. A lot of people thought it was a bad business decision. It is hard to make these assessments that you're talking about. And now what we have is this hindsight bias lawsuit where the FTC is seeking to break up, I guess what we now call it is Facebook Blue, Instagram, and WhatsApp. We're now reverse engineering it and making it look like there should have been some kind of obvious potential competition threat at the time of the acquisition. And I have to say, this lawsuit, I find kind of hard to take seriously. The FTC got past the pleading stage by making up this market for, personal social networking services. They basically gerrymandered things so that it would cover only Facebook and Snapchat. In discovery, the agency tried to identify a handful of features that made up this personal social networking market. Then they backtracked, arguing that virtually everything that occurs on Facebook and Instagram fits within the market. I don't see how that works. As Meta pointed out, if you watch a celebrity on Reels, how's that different from watching a celebrity on TikTok? The fact that your friends are like around or something, I don't see what the effect is. It gets even weirder when you consider that during the litigation, Meta has pivoted to trying to make Facebook and Instagram more like TikTok, which greatly undermines this market that the FTC has tried to concoct. It's slightly it's brutal. I mean, there was a brutal Wall Street Journal article saying, quote, there is little question internally that Meta's platforms lack the cultural power they once had. You know, as in so many big antitrust cases, the reality on the ground is shifting faster than the litigation can proceed. My take home from looking at this lawsuit is, again, to reiterate, it's just such a fraught enterprise to claim in the 2010s, you know, Facebook acquiring Instagram, this is going to be this huge thing. Many people miss that at the time. Then it's a fraught task to claim that you can fix it in hindsight. So what's your take on the FTC Meta lawsuit?
All right. So I'll say I have two handicaps here, maybe only one of which I'll admit, you know, in talking about this. And the main handicap is, of course, I was at the agency when it initiated it, what I'll call current investigation of Facebook's acquisition activity and conduct. I have some insight into how the agency staff and commissioners proceeded, and I want to be careful not to indicate anything that references that. So maybe I'll talk in some general issues. First, you do have to be very careful when you bring a lawsuit challenging a merger that's been consummated, particularly one or two that have been consummated roughly a decade prior, that you are not challenging a merger based on what I'll call the efficiencies associated with that merger, right? The taking of a product or firm that was not a competitive threat at the time, but through investment and distribution, making it look like it would have been successful absent the merger, right? The difficulty here, of course, is untangling the what I'll call the positive distributional and innovation and investment effects, you know, from Facebook/Meta's acquisition of Instagram and WhatsApp, the potential anti-competitive effects, which is, again, potential or alleged anti-competitive effects, you know, of removing one or two firms that had they been left to either grow alone or acquired by somebody else, would have been a meaningful competitor to Facebook. And of course, that is a very difficult, you know, question to answer, right? And as time passes, it becomes even more difficult. And of course, another core question is, okay, are we looking at the market as it exists today? Who are the firms participating in the relevant market today? What is the relevant market today? Or are we sort of looking back and saying, well, here's what the market was 10 years ago. Here's who the firms were back then. And sorry, we missed it 10 years ago. But if we go back and try to reconstruct the situation 10 years ago, we analyze the deal based on that reality, even if today's reality does not align with it. The case here, I think, is a harbinger, depending on how it goes, of where the agencies will go in the future. If the commission wins this case against Facebook, and I want to talk about the theory they bring it under, but if they win this case against Facebook, I think both agencies are going to look back at a whole series of acquisitions by, in the first instance, tech companies, and then the later instances by companies that are arguably, you know, as techy, but not as high profile. And then with respect to companies in all sorts of industries, you know, and basically try to unwind deals that current leadership at the agencies and in the executive branch more generally, and maybe even in the legislative branch, think have been problematic. Right. So what does all that mean? The agency is not proceeding under Section 7 with respect to the Section 7 of the Clayton Act with respect to Facebook or acquisition of Instagram and Meta. They're proceeding under Section 2 of the Sherman Act and basically have alleged a monopoly maintenance claim, which in the view of some, And I
just you mentioned that you had thoughts on the theory that they're bringing. Is that what
this is the theory? Yeah. So what I'm saying is this idea of sort of looking back and challenging a merger, you know, from the past. Arguably, it's a little difficult to do under Section 7. I mean, this is a view of some people. Arguably, it's a little bit hard to do under Section 7 of the Clayton Act. But arguably, it's easier to do as a Sherman Act claim, right? Where a monopolist, I'm speaking generally here, where a monopolist basically takes very defensive steps to protect its monopoly. What they're doing is not picking off the firm that they know is going to be a competitor, as an example, but they're just trying to pick off anybody that puts their head up that they can buy for, you know, a couple hundred million or, you know, a couple dozen billion dollars in securities, not cash, but securities, and just using that as a defensive mechanism and you know, called in the complaint and in some of the case law, you know, monopoly maintenance. If the agency gets a court to accept that idea, right, that an aggressive, what I'll call an aggressive acquisition strategy by a, you know, someone with monopoly power is, you know, does not require a true effects analysis, which is sort of what the agency's proposed here, that will cause, lead both agencies to bring a lot more of these cases because they believe there have been way too many acquisitions, particularly in hindsight, you know, should not have been allowed. So it's an important case. The theory proposed is arguably not a true competitive effects analysis. And if it passes muster in the court, it will be a significant change to merger law, and it will affect a significant change to merger enforcement policy.
So let's turn to Microsoft's bid to purchase Activision. Last December, the FTC launched an internal complaint to block that buy. The agency says that the threatened markets include high-performance consoles and cloud gaming subscription services. And my instinct, I have not read deeply into the video game market, so I could be wrong here, but my instinct is that this seems like kind of another gerrymandered market, because if you're taking Nintendo and PC gaming out, that seems highly fishy to me. I mean, they basically made it so the market is Microsoft with its Xbox and Sony with its PlayStation. And things get even fishier when you consider that, broadly speaking, Sony, through several generations of consoles, has basically eaten Microsoft's lunch here. So some people have sort of grumbled that this is the FTC carrying water for the Japanese video gaming industry. It's a vertical merger. Microsoft has offered commitments to keep Call of Duty, the major game produced by Activision, widely available. Nintendo and Nvidia have taken up those deals. I believe Sony, as of recording, is still rejecting it. Cross-platform play of a mass market game like Call of Duty is, you know, it's a powerful disincentive to foreclosure. There's a real whiff in this case to me of the AT&T Time Warner challenge, which was also vertical, which included this super weak claim that there'd be an incentive to withhold HBO, which just made no sense when you considered that a cable provider withholding its choice content would just be further hurting itself, further accelerating cord cutting and advantaging Netflix. Well, similarly here, the logic of purchasing Activision and then withholding Call of Duty seems questionable, especially given the deals that Microsoft is offering. So there's a lot of little signs here that seem to me that this is an incredibly aggressive lawsuit. But what's your take?
Look, I think it's aggressive, but in some sense, all of these matters that go to litigation in the usual sense are aggressive, right? Because parties don't litigate easy cases, right? Either it looks like something that'll be an easy win or easy loss for one of the parties, and they settle, or the agency, you know, doesn't seek relief. So I think in that sense, litigated cases should be the ones we sort of scratch our heads about and say, do they have the facts here? Does the theory make sense? You know, is the law on their side? I don't think on the law, I don't think this is a screwy case at all, right? This is a standard sort of foreclosure case. There's an asset. If you choose to, you know, not share that asset with your competitor, it may weaken competition either at the upstream or downstream level. So it's not a crazy theory. It's the basis of all foreclosure theories. It's, as you said, very similar to the AT&T Time Warner matter, where the content, the unique asset or the special asset was Turner Network and HBO, right? You know, the theory is if you withhold them from your rivals, sure, you lose money on the distribution of that content. But if there's very little competition at the, you know, sort of downstream or distribution level, people switch to your offering as, and, you know, from your competitors. So you know, you lose on the sale of the content, you win on the new signups to your distribution of that content, right? And which one is worth more, basically, governs your decision. So I think the theory's fine. I think the facts, particularly with the relief proposals or the remedy proposals that Microsoft has made, you know, make you question whether the agency is going to be able to show this type of foreclosure or threat of withholding. I think there's a reason they're moving full steam ahead on this, which I'll come to in a minute. The gerrymandered market. Look, as someone who doesn't play these types of games and who didn't have children who played these types of games, who played, I think the last thing we played was, you know, Wii, you know, on Nintendo's Wii station, and that kept our attention maybe for a week.
You said there were two handicaps for Meta lawsuit, and I was wondering if the second one was you're just going to say I'm not a big social media guy.
So, okay, so I was going to say that. And of course, the funny thing is, of course, Facebook is sort of used by people my age, but Instagram is not, and I hope TikTok is not. So it is hard. Not knowing the market is a real issue, and sort of commenting on what the agencies are doing, particularly with respect to market definition. Market definitions are often gerrymandered, right? Because, or appear to be gerrymandered, often because there is a subset of customers for whom there are only a few competitors who they'll look to. So, you know, now that may not be the right way to define market around the narrow set of customers, but it's pretty well accepted nowadays. And so I don't necessarily consider the market gerrymandered without knowing the facts, right? Is there, so are there some core group of users, and I'd call it a meaningful group of users to get at this magnitude question, magnitude harm, who, you know, Sony and Xbox are the only true alternatives. The agency should not be in the business of telling consumers, I know you like only these two firms, but we think you really ought to be looking at a broader set of firms, right, in your choice of preferences or who you like using, right? The companies do that, think about who their close competitors are and the like. The agency, I think, should not question consumer preferences, particularly when you have large numbers of consumers and you just can't interview them to understand, you know, why these are their two preferences, right? In a merger involving, you know, two industrial companies who sell to 50 customers, you can talk to the customers and they can tell you, they can give you a reason why they only like the merging parties. But sometimes you can say, well, isn't, you know, company three basically the same? Why don't you use them? And you can push back on this sort of decision set that the customer uses. In the consumer markets like this, you just have to accept it. And let's see what the evidence shows at trial. I think, though, this question of foreclosure, withholding, is going to be tough for the agency, particularly with the commitments the company seems to be willing to, Microsoft seems to be willing to make. And I think what's pushing this, what's leading the agency to move aggressively here, and I think this may underlie some of their other investigations and future potential, lawsuits, is they don't much like vertical integration. They think vertical transactions raise much greater likelihood of harm than agency officials have thought for the past, roughly 40 or so years, and that academics have thought over the last 40 years. They see vertical acquisitions both as much less likely to have efficiencies that cannot be obtained some other way. And I think they also see vertical acquisitions as more likely than folks in the past to be eliminating either a future competitor who repositions or an asset that would be used by a future firm as a means of entry into one or more relevant markets. I think they're pursuing this aggressively because they just don't think vertical transactions are as beneficial as we thought, and they don't want to be in the business of monitoring the relief. They don't want to be in the business of monitoring whether, let's say, Microsoft is actually providing access to, in this case, Call of Duty, basically on non-discriminatory terms.
Giving me an appetite to do an episode entirely devoted to just like the theory of the firm and double marginalization, but I think everyone would fall asleep, so we'll have to skip it.
So my experience at the FTC is not that people fall asleep. People who disagree on it will actually fight about it. So it might actually be quite interesting.
The small differences create the true battles. For those who are a little unclear, I'm discussing sort of the technical ways that people debate whether vertical integration is economically efficient. So there have been some accusations that the FTC is playing fast and loose or manipulating its internal tribunals. So the Wall Street Journal had an article where they said, it looks an awful lot like the FTC purposely got the EU to challenge the Illumina Grail merger. Side note, for more on that, we discussed it at length in Tech Policy Podcast episode 328. That's all I'll say about it to move forward. A merger can go through normally, unless the FTC gets an injunction in court. But if the EU challenges it and it gets gummed up, and we've also seen that going on with Microsoft Activision, the FTC can more comfortably go into its internal tribunal. And there it's got, its home standards, and it's got all kinds of advantages being in its own administrative court. I guess I should give another side note. We've talked about Axon, the major Supreme Court case that sort of tries to get around that tribunal, in episode 330, the FTC and FCC in court. The fact that they would sort of purposely, I think hide is a strong word, but try to keep things in their own tribunal and not want to go to court is suggestive of the fact that they maybe are not entirely confident of how well this is going to go in some of their cases. Do you see an overall strategy here? Is there a plan through, like, a thread that goes through these cases of how the FTC is going to move the needle and actually ultimately get court wins? Because it seems like no matter what they do, if they can't ultimately get judges on board, it's not pointless, but it will have limited effect and probably temporary effect. So are they just kind of being aggressive while they can and they're going to face a buzzsaw in court, or do you see a strategy here for them to actually make progress by their lights?
I do see a strategy. I think, though, that in some sense, in the Meta Within case, for example, they bowed to reality, right? So, think about it, both mergers and non-mergers. mergers that go through the Hart-Scott notification system, they can only be blocked, parties don't walk away, if the agency gets an injunction in district, district court, right? But at least under the statute, they are supposed to try the merits of merger cases in their administrative system, right? So they're in this sort of odd position, which if they don't go into district court, the parties consummate the merger, and then the FTC is, if it's challenging it, challenging a consummated merger through its administrative system, where somebody, or collectively, somebody gets three bites at the apple: the ALJ, the commission as a as an appellate body, and then the appellate courts as the, you know, in a sense, overseeing the commission. You can maybe do that in 3 years, right? Even counting the investigation period, but that's awfully long, and also pretty rapid. Long for parties to potentially proceed, and long for the commission to try to enact a sort of strategic plan, right? We're going to challenge a transaction today, and then in 18 months, we're going to, maybe 2 years, write an opinion that says we were correct, regardless of what the administrative law judge said. And then in a year, plus or minus, we'll get an appellate decision that says, yes, you were right, or no, you were wrong, or, well, maybe this needs to go back to the commission for some more inquiry, right?
And while all that is going on, just to interject, I mean, we talked about, say, the Meta lawsuit. Like, you're basically predicting what? Like, you're saying, we don't think a TikTok is going to rise up in that amount of time. Yeah. You know, we don't, like, the amount of prediction that goes into that just seems very, again, poking at this notion of that the FTC can predict the market. But please, go ahead.
Yeah. So changing merger law, you know, either you're trying to do it quickly through a PI hearing, right, or over a longer term through one or more series of administrative, you know, cases through administrative process. So whatever strategy you have is going to sort of be affected by both. Mm-hmm. And whatever strategy you have in any particular case, where you will usually, like in Meta Within, seek a PI with the intention of then doing a fuller analysis in the administrative process, you know, will change when you get a district court or Article III court opinion. I think the agency would have liked to have done a more aggressive sort of potential competition, future competition, nascent competition opinion through the administrative process. But at least on the facts, I think they got their clock cleaned at the district court. And I think they, whatever they wanted to do, I think they realized, you know, proceeding, finding an opportunity to write an opinion as a commission was just not, you know, changed after they read the factual analysis of the district court. I don't think they can be blamed for sort of reacting, right? There's a lot of moving pieces, but I think they have a coherent strategy, right? Which is more aggressively move to block mergers that other folks would not have done, would not have blocked in the last 30 or 40 years, would not have tried to block. And if successful, write opinions that implement their vision of the law. I spoke about that in the merger context. Now, one problem with this, both their objectives and the, you know, the pull and push and pull of the other actors in this, the district courts, the parties, is you have to make changes, and those changes look to the market like you're just creating uncertainty, right? That the sole strategy is just make it difficult for parties to merge. And, you know, I think there's a little bit of that. But mostly, I think they have a view of what they want to do. It's hard, And the, as they say, as some general says, you know, the enemy gets a vote. You tell Meta you're going to sue them, and Meta says, you know, okay, see ya. We'll see you in court. And then Meta doesn't lay down for them, and Microsoft isn't going to lay down, and other firms may or may not. On the conduct side, what they're looking for on the conduct side is to implement, I think what they should be doing, if I mean, from their perspective, looking for a conduct case or two to implement their recent policy statement on the scope, meaning, whatever, reach of Section 5 of the FTC Act. You know, the what does it mean to prohibit unfair methods of competition? Those are, again, they need a case or two in the administrative process where the current commissioners or their successors get to write an opinion that applies the current view, their view of what an unfair method of competition is, to actual facts and get an appellate court to accept that. And that's going to take some time. You got to find the right case or two. You got to investigate it. You got to think you have a good case. You got to run it through the ALJ, probably, and then up to the commission, and then up, you know, to the appellate courts. And you're going to have the same results after you win or lose at what I'll call the lower level. You say, okay, well, we thought it was X. The court or the ALJ is telling us it's Y. Do we think it's actually still X and we go ahead? Or it turns out it's Y and we don't go ahead, right? I think they moved a little slower than they could have, by distrusting the staff and not drawing on, you know, the strength of the staff, and that's handicapped them. But their plan and their strategy to me is pretty clear, but it can be upsetting. Here, the agency is being disruptive, right? They want to change the law. And those of us, including myself, who practiced under a different framework, can easily say, what the heck are they doing? They're just mucking it up. They're just creating, you know, turmoil for turmoil's sake. But that's not, I don't think that's right. They have a plan. It just takes a little while to implement it. It'll probably go nowhere if Biden's not reelected. But if Biden is reelected, over 8 years, they will at least be able to get cases to the appellate level, you know, and get decisions on the merits of their view of Section 7, Section 2, Robinson-Patman Act, you know, and most importantly, the scope of Section 5.
Yeah, that's very magnanimous of you. I think it is clear that just there are time pressures on so many different levels. You mentioned the political landscape and needing to win elections and holding power. The fact that litigation takes a very, very long time. As I've been harping on during the episode, the fact that markets move on day one, you look at Facebook and say, we really want to get them, they're too powerful. But then on day one plus X years or whatever, young people are flocking to TikTok and things look very different, and sort of the sand shifts out under your feet. Just investigating these massive companies takes a very long time. You know, in closing, I should definitely note, we should be seeing, or at least this is according to the news, the FTC bringing some antitrust actions against Amazon. That's any minute now. I wouldn't be surprised if that's out by the time this episode's released. And that investigation started in 2019. And here we are. It'll be interesting to see what's in that lawsuit. There's all kinds of different directions the FTC could go. On the sort of smaller side, you know, they could be upset about Amazon having had to, they concede this, that they didn't mean to, if you mean the executives, but they use third-party data of sellers to decide what markets to enter themselves. And going after that, I don't think would be in any way earth-shaking, but, you know, they could also, the FTC, say, we want to break apart your third-party market from your own brand sales, or they could say, you know, we want you to dismantle the Prime program. I'm just throwing things out here. I have no idea what it will say, but that is another big one floating around here.
Let me comment a little bit, if you don't mind, before you end.
Yeah, please.
And it brings up a point I wanted to make earlier. Look, I don't want this podcast to come off as, in a sense, a defense of what the agency is doing now. I think they're doing real harm, both in the procedures they're following and in the substantive path they want to go. Right.
Well, you've made it for a much more interesting conversation. I appreciate it.
They have a strategy, right? They have a strategy. But, you know, you mentioned the Lumina Grail. You just mentioned Amazon. You mentioned Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp. Well, Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram was filed in the previous administration while I was there. The Amazon investigations were started in the previous administration while I was there.
Very true.
You know, the current folks may pursue different theories. Who knows? And Illumina Grail, that was a case filed, you know, roughly 2 weeks after we left. By we, I mean me and Joe Simons and one or two others left the FTC. But the bureau director who filed that case was Joe's bureau director. You know, he stuck around to help with the transition from the, you know, Trump leadership to the Biden leadership. That was a case that I think would have been brought by the Joe Simons Commission. The vote on it was 4-0. So it would have been either 5-0 or 4-1 in the worst case. These, there are some things that, you know, the current folks are doing that I don't think we would have done and we didn't initiate. But we were looking at tech firms. We were concerned about nascent competition. Were we thinking correctly about innovation effects? So there's an aggressiveness that sort of began at the end of the Obama administration that, you know, has driven the agency, you know, for the last six whatever years with the current folks, you know, notching it up into areas that seem off.
I appreciate that. Your sort of spirit of moderation, shall we say, is a good note to end on, Bilal. This has been great. Thank you so much. Yeah, there's so much more to cover. I've done a number of FTC episodes without doing anything that's touched directly on Hart-Scott-Rodino. Maybe we'll talk about the Amazon suit later, but there will be more to come in the antitrust space and the FTC space here on the Tech Policy Podcast. So stay tuned. We've been joined by Bilal Sayed. I'm your host, Corbin Barthold. Thank you for listening. Till next time.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.